Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Feel free to use, feel free to make mood music too, Marie. Okay.
Okay, well,
Okay. Now, the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, or you will die." "You will not certainly die," the serpent said to the woman, "for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye, and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband, who was with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. Then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid from the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man, "Where are you?" He answered, "I have heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked. So I hid." Been in that situation, Marie. And he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from?" The man said, "The woman you put here with me, she gave me some fruit from the tree, and I ate it." Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this you have done?"
"Damn it, woman."
The woman said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate." So the Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and all wild animals. You will crawl on your belly, and you will eat dust all the day of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel." To the woman he said, "I will make you pay your pains in childbearing very severe. With painful labor you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you."
You will always make less than men.
To Adam he said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate fruit from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return." Adam named his wife Eve, because she would become the mother of all the living. The Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife, and clothed them. And the Lord God said, "The man has now become like one of us, knowing good and evil. He must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat, and live forever." Forever. "The man has now become like one of us, knowing good and evil. He must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat, and live forever." Why can't I say forever, Marie?
Because, dude, you're cursed. You got that whole, that original sin thing
so
happening.
So the Lord God banished him from the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he had been taken. After he drove the man
really
out,
dire.
He placed on the east side of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword flashing back and forth to guard the way to the Tree of Life. And that's how we're going to start this episode, Marie.
It's with a flaming sword and cherubim and seraphim.
Now,
wait, was there seraphim or just cherubim?
Just cherubim. One, right? Now,
with the flaming sword.
I do want to say on behalf of all men that I apologize for women.
Go fuck yourself.
And we're on the episode. Welcome to the Mad Scientist Podcast. Tonight's episode, Magical Clothing Part 2. Yeah. So that's a fun one. I'm just teasing. That's a fun one, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't know that fig leaves. So here's the thing I don't get. I didn't know, first of all, they didn't eat figs. It wasn't figs that got them into this whole, you know, kerfuffle to begin with. But pomegranate and or apple.
Well,
right?
they never say.
What, they just got the fig? They just went for the fig leaf because it was the biggest?
They never say what the fruit is.
No, but it's...
It's often portrayed as an apple or a...
Yeah.
Or a pomegranate.
But it's not a fig, right? Because they say that they call that by name, but the fruit of knowledge of a tree of knowledge is not given any kind of
it's not given a name, but nomenclature, listen, we all know it's a mango. A mango is the best fruit.
A mango is the best fruit.
But Thank you.
It's also not a fruit you can just bite into, right? Because they just bite into said fruit. So
that's
it
true.
Cannot be
that's
a mango.
True. Yeah, that's
or
true.
A banana.
Pineapple's
or an
out.
Orange. Pineapples are actually bushes and they grow out of the ground from below.
Oh my God. All right, listen, we're getting off topic here.
to be scientific.
This episode is on, again, magical clothing, but this time we are looking at it from a darker side, I guess. We're looking at clothing as, first off, clothing as punishment, clothing as moral.
Curse.
Moral, yes. Something, clothing as a curse, and clothing as a means of sort of hiding your true
judgment.
Self from the world. Right, judgment. Yeah, clothing
judgment,
as judgment.
Yeah.
So this is one of the first stories a lot of us are really taught in terms of religious things, right? I mean, like, you know, at least I remember being a kid and having a, being given a children's Bible. And I distinctly remember the section where they're talking about the serpent and the Garden of Eden and God. You know, they were naked at first, but of course they showed them underneath bushes and trees and stuff very artfully. So, like, they were still naked, but I couldn't see anything.
But they're all standing. Yeah, there's all, like,
yeah,
just
it's like, you know,
a cloud, a tree.
Right. Adam standing in front of a chipmunk who's kind of in the way of his balls. But it's interesting that one of the very first thing that they realize upon eating the fruit of knowledge and learning about good and evil is that being naked is evil in some way. Right. Which is a really, really interesting thing.
Very specific.
It's extremely specific, right? Like
very specific.
And it
not
begins
the enslavement of others or your will to dominate. It's that you're all bare ass naked out there.
Right. It is. It's a very, very specific thing. And it's something too that like it kind of creates the whole it really plays a foundational role in modern society still, right? Like if there's one thing that we've taken from the Bible, it's that nipples are very, very sinful. Right? Like, really? Like, seriously, though, right? I mean, I remember being a kid.
Was that in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John?
I don't remember, but I think it's...
Do not go forth and show nipples. No, yay, that... No, I'm just free-versing.
Well, it's an interesting thing, right? Like, of all of the things that are in the Bible that are good that you can take from it, right?
Yes,
in many ways, this is one that's kind of like maybe one of the worst lessons it can teach us, right? That that nudity or that like it creates a whole thing. Like I often wonder would some of the sort of like extreme fetishism necessarily because that's a whole different thing. Like would fetishism exist as it does today had we not made taboo so much of the basic human experience, right?
Well,
like
we're all born naked. Well, yeah, but I mean I can't help but wonder if these taboos weren't clearly prevalent before the book was written.
But
right?
My entire
sex kind of gets the sticky end of the lollipop on this go round.
Well, yeah, okay,
like,
of course, yeah.
That can't just be like out of the blue. You're just like, hey, you know what? She did it. That's fucked up.
Well, it's
we can't. We cannot trust them with anything.
It's certainly a way.
Don't
to...
let them drive. Don't what? what? You know, so no, I think that that must have been in existence before this, you know, it's just my two cents.
So, okay.
For the Old Testament.
See, now
I think but I think it's self-perpetuating in a lot of ways, right? It's like, I'm sure that misogamy and the fear of nudity or sort of that taboo existed at the time it was being written, because it was written into that text, and it just therefore reinforces everything going forward. It's a, you know, a self-sustaining narrative in a way.
Sure. Yeah. Kind of like, you know, you make, it's sort of similar to when we outlaw almost anything, right? It's like you make something illegal, but it's something, maybe not anything illegal, but like, you know, it's similar to like making drug use illegal, right? Like, you're going to outlaw an addictive drug, but it's addictive. So the people that use it the first time are going to want to use it some more. Right. So it's like,
yes.
It's,
and then you're going to underfund any way to, you know, yes. Anything around it, it becomes.
Similar to the same kind of thing. It's like, well, we're going to make being nude taboo. We're going to make nudity. We're going to make the body. We're going to make bodily functions, all this stuff, whatever, taboo. And then therefore, anyone that shows these very human problems or human things or whatever in modern life is shunned or made fun of or whatever, right?
Which kind of popular culture reference for Arrested Development for Tobias, the never nude.
Yes. There are dozens of us.
Oh my God.
Literally dozens of us.
I love that. Okay, sorry. What's one of our first Arrested Development? Like, normally we go straight into, you know, It's Always Sunny, but
I can't believe it. It's Arrested Development is one of my favorite shows.
It is. Why haven't we been referring to that like a lot?
I don't know. I don't know what's going on.
What's been wrong with us?
It's okay. This is the season of Arrested Development references.
Okay, excellent. Excellent.
So here's the interesting thing, I think, about a lot of this is that from the time of, and I think, Marie, there's something to be said about the idea that it goes back further than the Bible, right? Because I'm sure it does. And there has always been something about clothing almost as God's, like clothing is a way to prostrate yourself in front of God, in a sense, right? So I grew up in New York City, and there's a huge population, there is a sizable population, much more sizable than in other parts of the country, the United States, of Hasidic, various sects of Hasidic Jews, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so normal kind of like day-to-day drive around Brooklyn, whatever, you will see, no matter how hot it is, you are going to see a few people at least, and sometimes a lot of people if you're in the right communities and stuff, that are wearing like extremely warm looking wool
suits
and hats. Trench coats and these big full fur hats on their heads.
Yes.
Or just
the fedora, the regular fedora. God, it's so warm.
It's yes. Right, and the women wearing full length shirts with sleeves and multiple layers and everything, right? With the big dresses all the way down to the floor. You know, it's a very interesting way to show your allegiance to a faith, right? And it's also part. I mean, and a lot of faiths have that. I mean, in Islam, you have the hijab and the other sorts of, you know, the other sorts of robes and clothing and stuff that can be worn. You have in Christianity, you have the cross that people wear around their necks, or the very, in some certain sects of Christianity, right? Mormonism, let's say, you have undergarments that you wear specifically. You have
the holy underwear. That's right.
You have specific rules as to what you can or can't wear, right? Like, this is a part of a lot of religious practices, and it is a very interesting one to me, because it signifies, like, not only does it signify to you that, like, it's a constant reminder almost that you are a sinning or sinful creature, right? It's like the constant chafing in the hot Utah sun is a sign that you, do you know what I mean though?
Yeah.
Like, do you get that same feeling, Marie? Like, it's a feeling of, not necessarily oppression in the sense of like, you know, because I'm sure many of these people are very, have a lot of faith and are very happy to do it, right? But well, it's, think, yeah, it's like a really quick way to socially signify that you are of this sect. And actually, that's something else that we wanted to get into. So I think this general idea of clothing as both a reminder of one's, or the reminder of potential evilness or sin, and then also the idea of clothing as social status symbol almost, or showing of yourself to the world, all really interesting and all stuff that we kind of want to get into, right? So let's start off actually with the idea of clothing as a curse, or clothing as a reminder of something bad that you've done or someone in your past has done.
Mm-hmm. Right, like so, almost like a perpetual judgment.
Yeah. So Marie,
you're wearing everywhere you go. Yes.
Yeah. So you had some stuff on this, right?
So my clothing is cursed mostly come from popular culture and literature. And okay. I think the interesting thing about when you start to tell the story of someone who has a cursed object or cursed clothing in books or in movies or whatever, it can, you know, it in itself is interesting, but it also can be somewhat of a MacGuffin, which I think we discussed like way back in season one, which is some sort of narrative device that is the center of attention or is seemingly a big plot point, but is really just used to move the action of the story along. And is actually has no relevance or meaning, any intrinsic meaning to the story. And I think that that comes up, sort of that balance between it being a signifier and it being sort of something that is just a to use to move the story to the next sort of the meaning of the story along is something that is kind of interesting that I've seen come up again and again. But I think the one that came to my mind and also in researching was Miss Havisham from Great Expectations, who is in a wedding dress the entire story, right? And she's in a wedding dress, Charles Dickens, because she was jilted at the altar. And that action, not just jilted, but she was literally like, I think I'm trying to, now I've got to, you know, I'm trying to get into my like, oh my God, Victorian England literature class. What was it? She wasn't just jilted. She was embezzled, or the man who she was going to marry, who she thought was well-to-do and wealthy, ended up being a swindler and took her for all of her worth.
Okay, so she was bamboozled.
She was bamboozled, and so
all right.
As a after effect, she's wearing the same wedding dress for centuries. Right. And so she kind of walks around and she's like almost a ghost because she's wearing this wedding dress, and she it affects, you know, she ends up adopting a girl who falls in love with Pip, Estella. I think. Yeah. Estella falls in love with Pip, and Miss Havisham is the figure who sort of stands between them until she has her, you know, her repentance. And, you know, finds no fault with true love type of thing. But it's like this permanent, you know, she doesn't wear anything else. It's clearly creepy. And it's also a very visual reminder of fidelity, monogamy, you know, a successful relationship, falling in love. And she's just sort of wasting away within this and moltering away in this. In this wedding gown, which I think right. is well, it's very also cursed.
Yeah, it's also in a way a reminder of kind of the, you know, it's a reminder of the hurt and the fail, you know, not the failure mm-hmm. necessarily on her part, but a failure of her marriage, right? Or the yes. failure of this thing that she hoped for. I mean, it's very similar to, when people will mourn and they'll wear black clothing, right? I think there's a story. It's a story in my family that I don't even know if this is true. I assume it's true, but I'm not even sure that one of my grandmas, not my actual grandma, but like a mm-hmm. you know, a grandma of the family that hung around when her husband died, she wore black and a mourning shawl for like a whole year. Right? And this was in, like, 1970s Brooklyn. So I'm sure she looked very out of place. But, you know, like, it's an interesting...
It's creepy, right? It's like the morning you were expecting sort of, you know, this wearing of black and, you know, covering mirrors. And there's an appropriate amount of time for doing this. But then just for like decades afterward, you know,
for it to keep going,
in this decay is just, again, it's totally Dickensian, right? It's like, you know, she's humiliated. She's just reliving this one single event with the inability to move on.
It's also very similar though to, I think, almost what, I mean, this is a little bit of a stretch, but very similar to sort of what some people will do when faced with a big life changing or life altering, and in a bad way, life altering event where they begin to, like compulsively hoard items, right? I mean, it's sort of a way of saying, you know, listen, I give up. I'm no longer going to address myself or try to put an outward face to the world and say, you know, well, this is the way that I see myself, right? I see myself as someone who's mourning, or you know, in the case of Great Expectations, I see myself as someone who was given the bamboozling of a lifetime. Right. I will never forget the bamboozling. Right.
Well, yes. And just not being able to, there is nothing beyond that moment. And that the interesting thing too, but is so perfect, is if you have to think about all of the, any item of clothes that sort of is worn at a particular moment, there's only very few things that are sort of indicative or symbolic of one certain thing, right? I can think of maybe christening gown for a child, but a wedding gown, it's like that is hugely culturally significant, and it's also not something you're going to be waltzing down the street with, right?
No, it's one of those things that you buy for like one day and you never wear it again, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Did Katie, by the way, when and you got married, did Katie have a wedding gown?
Katie, no, we did a very like small kind of, I guess, like, well, small. We did a very intimate and, I guess, kind of modern wedding, I would say. So Katie had a beautiful wedding dress that she wore, but not a white wedding gown.
Not a gown.
Right.
And has she worn said dress since then?
I know she's not.
Oh. Okay.
But Katie is also pretty much every day covered in animal guts from her job. Right? So not
as you
the
do.
Best. Yeah. So, you know, not the, I mean, vet school, not the greatest place to be wearing.
Just curious.
Yeah. No, it is interesting though. I mean, I think that they're, so it's interesting that you mention these pieces of clothing that are like, they're sort of, I guess they're also sort of charged emotionally.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Because there are these, they're for these special days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And actually we have a lot of pieces of clothing like that, that end up becoming, like you said, these kind of MacGuffins, or even, there's some idea that clothing in some way is kind of, clothing is the way that we show ourselves to the world. Right.
Yes.
And clothing is also, as we mentioned in the last episode, in many ways, a sign of your status or your station in life. Right. So, you know, if you're a pharaoh or a king or something, you have a very specific set of clothing that you're allowed to wear that other people are not. Right. You and it's true of like everything. Right. I mean, you can think about and we're going to get into this more, but you can think about, like, you know, if you go outside and you're wearing, you know, I don't know. There's clothing that signifies you as something, right? Like if you are wearing a lab coat and a stethoscope, people assume that you're not just some fucking weirdo who bought a stethoscope and a lab coat. People assume that you're like a pediatrician.
You're
or something,
learned.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Like people assume that you can do something with that stethoscope.
But it is a signifier of something. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so, and then there's more subtle ways that that's true too, right? I mean, if you're wearing, you know, if you're wearing combat boots and a punk, you know, a shirt from a band mm-hmm. no one's ever heard of, people assume you're into punk rock, right? If you're wearing, I don't know, suspenders and a stupid hat, people think you like ska like I do, right? Like, there's very specific signifiers here that may not even mean a lot to you if you're outside of the subculture itself, right?
Right.
But anyways, right. But there is something, this idea of someone desiring or being envious of a piece of clothing, getting it, and then by getting that piece of clothing, ruining their lives, right? It's sort of a very right. like comeuppance kind of thing. And so one of my favorite versions of this is the fairy tale The Red Shoes or The Red Slippers, depending on what country you get it from. And so this story is this girl basically says that she hopes that she can get basically a red pair of red slippers or dancing shoes or something, right? And that she wants to get these and whatever. And so what ends up happening is that she becomes so excited about these shoes and falls in love with them so much that she wants to wear them to church. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But her mother, or not even her mother necessarily in most tellings, but an old woman that she knows who's at church with her, whatever, is told, well, you have to wear black shoes to church to show respect. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, but she, this young girl cannot actually deal with that. She has to wear these red shoes everywhere. Right. She loves it. And so when she goes to church the next weekend, an old man meets her and he says, you know, well, what? Wow, those shoes would be really good for dancing, wouldn't they? Right. And he says to her, you know, I hope that they never come off of you when you dance.
Mm.
Right. And can't, you know, this woman mm-hmm. after church, right. She cannot stop herself from dancing. And she just now is forced to dance constantly. She's just, you know, she's going around dancing and going nuts and whatever.
Right.
Right.
Which is the price of for avarice and for, you know, materialism and greed. Right. Or but she was so taken by these shoes that she took them over her faith, which is basically what the saying or what I would interpret that as. Right.
Yeah. And so, well, yeah, it's a. And so in different tellings of the story, there are, it becomes more elaborate. There's mm-hmm. one case where it's an old woman who takes her in after her own mother dies. And Karen basically, like, you know, gives her so much grief about, you know, I don't have anything nice. Why don't you get me new shoes, whatever, that she buys her the shoes and then she's not even being respectful with them. This old man curses her at church. And then when the mother, this old woman taking care of her, is lying on her deathbed, the girl decides to just go out dancing. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's like a story of almost a story of disrespect or a story of the clothes. Yes. The shoes mm-hmm. signifying the excesses in the face of
yes.
responsibility
yes.
and proper etiquette and whatever. And actually, in some cases, she dies so much, or she dances so much that it kills her.
Mm-hmm.
And then an angel comes down and tells her soul that she has to keep dancing even after death.
Jesus, man, come on,
right?
Now. Yes.
And then a little dire.
Just saying.
And so then her feet, which have become ripped off from her body, continue to dance in these shoes. And so the ghost of this woman, like, forces the shoes to go to church or whatever
mm-hmm.
to be like, look at this. Isn't this weird, everybody? Look, woo.
This is what happens.
And then everyone.
This is why we can't have nice things. Sorry.
Yeah. And so then afterwards, she, you know, none of these tricks that she's trying to do to get back into God's graces work. And so finally she decides she's just going to pray. She's just going to pray to God and be humble and ask for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And God gives her forgiveness. And she goes to heaven, right? But still,
mm-hmm.
like,
mm-hmm.
again, this is the story of God just straight up being like, yeah, you want the damn shoes?
Here you go.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's a very interesting story, and it's one that the story of a piece of clothing as a cursed item, a piece of clothing as a point of envy and a point of greed, and then the greed swallowing up the person in some way. Well, right. It's a very common trope.
Well, I think that reminds me of one other one that I have that I think is, again, from books, which is sort of fitting in the same vein, which is from F. Scott Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby, is the part where Daisy is crying over Gatsby's shirts. So he comes in and he shows her sort of his entire wardrobe, which is stocked with all these major, beautiful, finely custom-made shirts. And she literally breaks down and starts to cry, and she says something like, "They're just such beautiful shirts. They're so beautiful." And it's sort of this weird, tense, strange moment, because you've never seen the other side of Gatsby that isn't about sort of this abundance and wealth and materialism. And yet this woman who he's trying to impress kind of has this strange reaction to his beautiful shirts. And like, what do they symbolize for her, and what do they symbolize for him, is sort of this, again, this materialism. But even beyond that, like, who was he when he wasn't, when she fell in love with him before he was the Great Gatsby? And is that the person that she truly, you know, loves and remembers? And now this person who has all of this material wealth is not the same, or is trying too hard to win her back. And it's just this really poignant, strange, jarring part of that novel, which is again, like, almost a punishment, right? It's almost like you have something and you covet it so much, like the shoes or these beautiful shirts, that it's just never, there's never enough, right? It's like Gatsby's has hundreds of custom-made shirts, right? Which is like sort of, again, just this excessiveness, or the putting on the shoes and having them have such a hold on you, but all you can do is dance in them is this sort of retribution for excess. And I think that is, again, like, one of the things that clothes are so perfect at pointing out is the abundance almost taken, like, too far. But it's, you know, clothes are supposed to keep you warm. They're supposed to keep you safe. They, you know, they serve a purpose, right? They got us tossed, you know, they're the first thing we went to when we got tossed out of Eden. But they can also serve almost as this sort of retribution if you have too much.
Well, it's also... It's also almost an interesting sort of, it's almost a sort of like greed begets, or sin begets sin kind of story, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. if clothing was an original punishment for our sin, for our original sin, then the greed or the excess, like you're saying, of owning opulent clothing, it's like a sin. It's like turning a punishment back into its own sin, yes. right? It's almost like, it's almost like, I don't know, people that get fetishes for spankings or something, right? It's like, you're being punished. This isn't supposed to be fun for you, right?
It's, and it's
but just like, it's interesting.
Excessiveness. Like,
look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Because I'm always, you know, in thinking about it, and, you know, because again, going back and researching it, this is one that comes up, and it's like, it is this weird part of the book where you're like, why would she cry over shirts? You know, like, why is this such an emotional moment? But then you also think, like, kind of almost like, how much does one person need before they are sated, right? And it's sort of like the Tantalus, like, You will always reach for the grapes. The grapes will pull out of range. You will always, you know, bow to the water to only have it recede. Kind of, you will never have enough to make you happy is sort of, I think, what comes out of the, like, the moral lesson from something like Gatsby, and especially shown with clothes, which to me is like, that's so perfect. Cause it's like, of course, that's like, if you had a lot of money, that's probably one of the first things that you would use, again, as a social signifier to show I am of wealth, right? I am of status. I made it, right? That's the easiest way besides, you know, car or whatever. It's almost even more prevalent is the clothes. So, and just that almost becoming this, you know, almost sickening thing is interesting.
Right. I find it, it's also kind of interesting, Marie, tonight we're two for two for books that Chris was assigned to read in high school but never did.
Great Expectations and Gatsby?
Yeah, I didn't read any of, I think the only book that I was assigned in high school to read, and now actually one of my high school teachers is actually a listener now. Mr. Erlenwine.
Mr. Erlenwine, he never read any of this. I think he went straight for the cliff notes, man.
No, I mean, I didn't even do that. I actually got into trouble once. Not trouble necessarily. I got into kind of an interesting problem where we were reading. What the hell was that
interesting
book?
Like interesting as in I faked the entire thing and
yes what I made book? Up the entire thing. I'm trying to think what the what was the book? It was
your teacher's just like
it might even have been Great Gatsby actually.
What?
Where
okay, Gatsby is not even a novel, it's more like a novella. It's like 200 pages, dude.
The only one of those books that we got assigned that I actually read was Frankenstein.
Oh yeah, Well, that's
the
good.
Only one, and that one was because I had read it already.
That's good.
But there was a section in one of those books where they were talking about an ottoman and how the ottoman as a piece of furniture was like a signifier of like opulence or something, right? It was like I don't remember what it was, but because this is what I used to do was when the teacher would ask questions that I thought I could bullshit my way through to get points to make it look like I was reading the books. I would answer the questions, right?
Uh-huh.
Because the questions would be things like, you know, like, okay, well, like, let's say, like, what do you think the shirts signify for the Great Gatsby? Like, I know enough about the Great Gatsby to know that it's, like, a signifier of, like, wealth, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, like, 9 times out of 10, maybe I get it, I answer weird, but it's not terrible. And then that one time, I, like, hit it out of the ballpark, and I'm like, yes, I did it. This time, I went on a whole thing about how the Ottomans were an empire at the time, but they like had fallen apart right after World War I and all this other stuff. And the teacher was just like, she was just like, yeah, that's interesting you say that, but we're talking about the Ottoman as like a piece of furniture.
What book was this from?
I don't remember, but I just made a complete ass of myself. It was good times.
Oh, man. Dear listeners, if you can figure this one out, you get some special brownie points.
It was some book for English majors out there. Yeah, it was book.
I bet Tess Feifel knows this
I
one.
Bet Tess knows exactly down which cold. One it was. But anyway, so
God, you're such a punk. Can't even bother to read it. You're all out.
I didn't read them.
I will now pontificate for the next 12 minutes.
I'm the kid that today I hate. It's great.
Ah!
So another idea with clothing that kind of comes up too in the same idea is clothing as a way to either hide one's identity or even augment it, right? So we've talked a bit already about it augmenting one's identity, right? Like you put on clothing as a signifier, you put on clothing as a way to show to the world, like, you know, like this is, look at what I have and whatever. Another idea that's really interesting is clothing as a way of actually hiding one's true self from the world. And so I got two kind of general ways to go into this, right? So one really cool one is, we had a really interesting thing, from, Michael, who's part of the, Igor. And so,
Igor.
He put up a really interesting thing on Italian carnival dress, and specifically, a thing that used to happen, I guess, in kind of the 9th and 10th century Venice. So basically, Venice was super open to kind of promiscuity and sin and kind of like bad behavior so long as you were wearing a mask. Right. So it got to the point because like the Venetians would wear basically wear masks to go to these kind of orgies and go to secret meetings and stuff and do things in secret. Right. And so basically the Catholic Church at the time really liked Venice because it was a, you know, kind of an economic powerhouse. Right. And it was for a really long time, mm-hmm. actually. And so the Catholic Church though, decided that, you know what, these masks, they got to go. Right. Like, you know, you can't, just because you're wearing a mask doesn't mean God doesn't know you're sinning. Right. Like God can see through the mask, stupid. Right. And so basically the church outlawed these masks, and then there was a big protest throughout Venice. And so the church relented and said, OK, well, you can wear your masks only during certain times of year. Right. And the time of year that they decided to allow them to wear their masks was from Christmas through Shrove Tuesday, a period that became known as Carnival, which means without meat. Right. And so it's basically it's come to represent for Italians a period of kind of, you know, we rebelled against the powers that be to keep our Italian spirit, you know, forward. And it's a really interesting one because, you know, my uncle, my family is straight from Italy, right? My mom's side anyways. And I had a Nona. And we had my mom, we actually had Carnival masks on the wall of our entryway in our house when people came in. And now I'm like really worried about the poker parties. You know, what were they poking? Right? I'm concerned. I'm concerned. Anyways, so that's kind of
Dora
listen to this part. So who are we kidding? She listens to every single episode. Dora, number one fan of my entire life. Anyways, friend of the pod. So this actually brings up a really interesting idea that's been around for a really long time, and really one of my favorite versions of it is in The Republic by Plato. And specifically, it's in the story of the Ring of Gyges. So the idea is that there is a mythical ring from this time period about basically this king, the Gyges of Lydia, who founded a dynasty, whatever. And so there are different accounts of kind of how he became powerful. But in general, the myth is that he was originally kind of like the underling to King Candaulus of Lydia. He then kills the king somehow, takes the throne, and then takes the wife of the king. So he seduces the queen as well. And so the story goes that supposedly he did this. Supposedly he did this by finding a ring that when he wore it, he became invisible. And so he was then able to invisibly, you know, seduce the queen and kill the king and take over, right? And so now the story in The Republic, it's really a story about whether or not morality or virtue and justice and the good, being a good person, is that merely a social construct, or is there something intrinsically valuable in being a good person, right? So this is really an argument between Glaucon, who is said to be a brother of Plato, and Socrates, right, who is the main character in Plato's The Republic and a lot of Plato's works. And there's actually some really interesting question about who the real Socrates was. There's a very interesting, like, the stuff that we think we know about Socrates, we get from Plato or Aristotle, and so it's probably, like, them making up a character. You know what I mean? Like, it would almost be like, it would almost be like if, I don't know.
If I made up Chris Cogswell, or better yet, if Scott Philbrook, the man of three first names, made up.
Yes, it would be very similar to say if Scott created an elaborate story about a co-host. Maybe he could call, maybe he could call him, yes. I don't know, maybe,
something easy to remember.
Like, I don't know, maybe like planes. Or no, planes.
No, nah, something. It would have to be a planes is a hard word.
Maybe something that reminds you of trees, maybe, or nature. I don't know. I don't know. Anyways, but he could make him up, and then he could, you know.
But it would be a social construct, right. Nonetheless.
No, it'd be a complete yes. Fabrication. Anyways, agreed. So okay, so the Ring of Gyges. The story basically says that basically what's happening here is Glaucon is asking Socrates. Glaucon doesn't think that if you had the ability to become invisible at will, that any person would be able to keep themselves from being doing something unjust or immoral, right? That if you had the ability to become invisible, or to put it more generally, if you could get away with a crime without any repercussions because no one could ever know it was you, what would stop you? What logically would stop you from committing the crime, right? And it's a very similar one to like the question of, you know, if you could if you're at a red light at nighttime and it's midnight and there's no other car around, whatever, do you run the red light or do you wait, right?
Oh, I run the red lights in the middle of the day, so that's really not applicable. But no, but it's like there is something to being like the perception of the self, right? Like that you can perceive yourself in the body as being a mortal person that will be judged. But if you can't see yourself, and if no one can see you, because it's almost more important in this scenario that you can't see you. Not so much that you cannot be perceived by others, but you can't even be perceived by yourself.
Well,
and that's where the moral construct comes into play.
I actually read it a different way. I don't think it has anything to do with you. I think it has more to do with the idea of,
it is a perception. Good is a perception.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like good is a perception that we put on other people. Right. And so what Glaucon's point is that there is nothing intrinsically good about being moral or not committing crime, so to speak. It's merely we don't commit crimes because of the social repercussions that would occur to us, right? And what Socrates' argument would be, and what Socrates' argument is that actually justice, it doesn't matter if someone can see you or not, being just and being good is about more than just, more than simply being caught. It's about giving into your, about giving into your appetites, or giving into your pleasures, right?
Right.
Whereas, so in other words, to Socrates, to be just or to be good, to be good or virtuous or moral is to refrain yourself from your animal appetites, right? So in...
Right. But again, you would still have to have a perception of
yourself.
Yes,
you do.
But that's the thing, right? Like, if you can't see yourself, it's almost an erasure of your being, and you don't have any. You have no... construct, you have nothing in which to be moral, right? So if you can't see yourself, I think it's almost more
okay. So you're saying, I understand what you're saying too, though, that you think that. See, but the thing is that you, the thing is that you know that you're still around, though. Right? It's not like you're born invisible.
But do you? If you can't see yourself, of course. But how much would that fuck with you if you can't see yourself? You have no, nothing is reacting to you because you can't just be seen. Then how do you exist? How is that?
Well, you can just take the ring off whenever you want, though.
Well, yeah, but.
I do get what you're saying, though. It's almost interesting because it's kind of like what occurs to Gollum in Lord of the Rings, right? Like by being invisible for so long, he becomes almost a creature defined by his appetites, right?
Yes, you have nothing else to guide you.
Now, what I find really interesting with this story generally is that it is a really interesting one for modern day society. I mean, it's still a really great story and a really great question, right? Like, if you could, And it's actually one that was brought up for a lot of people, I think, when they thought that they were going to be nuked to death in Hawaii. Right? Like, did you read some of the...
I work with some people that live in Hawaii that, like, you know, that weekend, like, afterwards, that Monday, we had a conference call, and they were on, and we were like, hey, so what was up with that? And
I would have called out of work.
Their feedback was just horrifying. I was like, holy... Like, I didn't... You know, you hear about it, and you sort of heard about it, like, to start just sort of ad hoc. Like, you didn't wrap your head around what they were saying. Until, like, I don't know, it was like 48 hours later, and I was talking about it and hearing more about it in the news, and it's like almost 40 minutes of sheer panic. Like,
well,
world
yeah, I mean,
panic.
I don't think we're really giving... I actually think almost that, again, this is kind of a thing of social perception where the people in mm-hmm. Hawaii that did some, like, really crazy shit, they're never going to admit to it, right?
Ooh.
Like,
no.
Like, if I thought I was in imminent, if I thought that in 45 minutes or less, I was going to be killed, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I would,
mm-hmm.
I don't
Something
know what I would, well,
happen,
no,
right?
Like, you yeah. would, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's like the Ring of Gyges, right? You are mm-hmm. erased yep. from the face of the earth, and there is no evidence of what you did because the bomb is so all-encompassing, right? So it's like there are no repercussions. You can do whatever you want in these last 45 minutes and no one will ever know, right?
Yeah, but you're so practical, you'd be getting your shit together. You'd be all MacGyver in that shit. You see, here's the other thing is, like, I work with doctors and, like, people, like, because I know my main response would be, like, I think I'd fucking freak out. And these people, like, the stuff they were saying was so amazingly logical. Like, one was like, I got a tarp, I got duct tape, I got respirators, I got water.
Wow,
like,
that's really smart.
Shit. That's like
yeah,
100
that's good.
Times
that's
smarter
really good.
than me just, you know, trying to figure out if I'm being punked or something. I mean, it was like, I couldn't believe that. But that's like, I don't know. To me, it's like, I was not put under that same
yeah.
construct, right? If something like that happened, you don't know how you're going to react, because I think it is a pure reaction. And I am impressed when somebody is able to sort of have that moral construct to perform in that way. Because God only, you
yeah.
know, Jesus.
Well, I saw one thread.
That saved my, like, my Star Wars feed.
I saw a thread on Reddit where people were saying what they did when they thought that it was going to happen, right? And actually, I actually did hear from a friend at work who said that she has friends that live in Hawaii, and when they thought that they were going to get blown up, basically, they just, like, sobbed for, like, 30 minutes. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
they just cried and cried and cried and freaked out and, like, held each other and whatever. And she was like, you know, afterwards, she was like, people called and, like, were, you know, she was like, my friends called and told me that they loved me and they were, you know, so glad that nothing happened and they wanted to come visit now. And it's like, you know, I mean, I don't think we're really, like, I don't think people are, like, laughing about it like it's a big joke or whatever. And it's kind of funny, I guess, but it's also, like, pretty damn
horrifying,
right? But so one of my favorites that I read online and people were saying, you know, well, what did I do, was one guy was like, he went to the beach. He, like, got a jug of water, whatever. He, like, dug it out or whatever. And, you know, he like, hid some stuff, food and water and bull crap like that, whatever. But then when the bomb, like, when the initial blast was going to happen, his plan was to mm-hmm. be in the ocean. And then that way he would just dive, like, 100 feet, you know, whatever. However many feet down he could get to the bottom before he, like, couldn't get up anymore. And basically his plan was, like, to go all the way down and just wait it out down there. Right. And, like, I don't remember. I don't think he said anything about having, like, an air tube or anything up to the surface, but, like, that's a surprisingly good, like, a practical solution. And I actually did some digging online to see how good that actually would be. Right. And so before we finish out this episode, that's been pretty heavy on philosophy and jokes about nudity. I thought we can get into a little bit of science here. So, Marie, nuclear bomb goes off.
Yes.
What do you think is going to happen?
Well, first of all, they didn't specify it was nuclear.
That's true.
It was ballistic.
That's true.
Assuming it would be nuked. We were assuming it would be a. It's an.
That's true.
ICBM, right? So I, what would
like,
I do?
Like, no, not what would you do?
Or what would I?
Like, what do you, what do you think, how is it gonna, what's gonna happen?
What would withstand? What's gonna happen? What's gonna happen? Well, so, it depends on where it's coming from. Sorry, I hate to be all caveat this. All right, and
let's say it's coming from a...
But, hold on. It's coming from, it's coming from Korea.
But a North Korea that can actually fire a missile correctly. Like, it...
I was gonna say, so there's a huge percentage that it wouldn't land.
They have
shitty
targeting.
It's no, archipelago?
Yeah.
Archipelago. It's a, you know, so it's... It would have to hit land. If it hit land... It would, I would say it would pretty much take Hawaii out cold, because Hawaii's infrastructure is not, they're an island, so it's not like, you know, it's not, I don't want to say it's not a robust infrastructure, but it's an infrastructure that's based on
on an island. I would say that it's certainly not, it's not like you can keep going on the road until you find a non-irradiated area.
Right.
Like, you're like, you're on the island, you're going to run out of land eventually.
And if it takes out a power grid, it takes out absolutely. The power grid. And there's nothing that's going to solve that. So I think it would probably be pretty
so
bad.
Here's kind of what actually happens when a bomb goes off, right?
Oh, good. This is
Yeah, this is upbeat. So first off, there's the initial impact of the bomb itself.
Yeah. Can we talk about like what small groups of animals are called?
just to get into it.
What's a group of quails called? A coven.
Okay, that's very cute.
A quilt. I don't know. I'm going to make these up. Great. Great. By the way.
So basically, like, first you have the impact itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you have sort of the... what's it? Then you sort of have the
still, and then the seismic blast back, right?
Exactly. So then you have the actual, like, the actual pressure itself. Because what happens when a what's the word? So first off, you have the force itself from the actual hit, right? And then you have
damage.
No.
The hit itself then is from not that the damage. Hit, yeah.
Right. Usually you have. Usually you have some kind of chemical reaction or explosion, right? So a huge amount of heat that is released, right? Okay.
Yes.
So that heat then, basically it heats up all the surrounding air, and PV equals NRT. So pressure times volume equals the number of gas molecules times a constant times temperature. So as the temperature goes up, and the volume stays the same, then the pressure also goes up. Okay.
Really quick, a group of pot-bellied pigs, pygmy pot-bellied pigs. They're a posse.
Oh, are they really?
Continue. No, I'm making every single
goodness.
Thing up.
Okay, well, that would have been really cute.
But they're a posse. Keep going. I have to throw these in here because I didn't know we were going to get some
diary. So what happens then is that basically a blast wave forms. Right. And so basically the pressure from the gas being heated up so much starts to kind of flow away. And then we have a shock wave. Right. OK.
Yes. Which is really fucked
up. And so
up.
Then that is the thing that that is the thing that really does the damage, so to speak. Right.
Mm-hmm.
After the actual detonation and the shockwave that forms, right? You then also have some blowback as well as pressure gets because like you have a high pressure wave moving towards you, and then pressure the edge behind it is low pressure, so it's pressure that has to get kind of resettled, right? And then
it's like exactly
it is just like a wave of water, right? And so then you also will have some particles and like you know like frag. You'll have fragmentation of surfaces and things that actually occur, right? So so that initial blast, the damage that occurs from that initial blast is all determined by, it's a pressure wave, right? So it all depends on the density of the gas or the medium by which the pressure wave is moving through, Okay.
So if you're, how far underwater would you have to be?
So actually, they did some of, it depends on the blast, right? But they did some of that on Mythbusters.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? You do not have to be very far even to be protected from a bullet. Mm-mm. Right?
Right.
In water. Because water is, I mean, at least 1,000 times more dense than air. So we're talking a change in propagation of a significant amount, right? So actually, that would be the first part where that getting underwater would be a good idea, right? So long as the person could continue to breathe, right?
Yeah, I was gonna say so long as you could breathe,
as they are careful. Because actually, what's interesting is the body is your body is very, very carefully equilibrated to pressure, right? So that's what.
Yes. So you get the bends. Yeah,
same thing could probably happen then. I don't actually know if this has ever been. I have no idea about if this is true or not. I'm just supposing here that if you had a high pressure wave going over, say, your snorkel and you're under the water, your body itself might be protected, but your lungs and the pressure there, you would have extremely high pressure moving across the top of your nozzle for your, I don't know if your lungs would actually just explode or if they would be sucked out. It's actually a very interesting question. So,
a group of hedgehogs? A Hiddleston?
We're just making these all up. These are great. A
group of hedgehogs are called.
This is adorable.
That's a Hiddleston.
So, okay.
Yes.
So that first part, the pressure wave.
There has to be eight or more otherwise for it to be a Hiddleston.
It's just a bunch.
But it really, it's named after the actor Hiddleston.
Nice.
Yes.
So, so from the pressure wave, I think you'd be okay. But with a nuclear weapon.
Go back to exploding.
With a nuclear weapon, you have to worry about then nuclear radiation and fallout.
Yes. Well, you got the whole aftermath, right? That's now, the key of the nuke.
Actually, in that case, too, water is a really good, water is a very good way to stop certain types of nuclear radiation, right? Because, again, it's dense. Relatively dense. Mm-hmm. It's so actually we use water in nuclear reactors. We use water as a means of controlling the heat of the reaction, but also the flux or the flow of neutrons around a nuclear reactor during a fusion reaction. Mm. Right. So anyways, so I actually really like the idea of getting under the water. I think that'd probably be a pretty good one. I also saw some stuff though that some guy was like his boss went into the boss's room and like I think he said
career-ending move.
I think he said like
minutes,
he like took a dump on his desk or something. And like I don't know. So like some of these are probably fake, but I don't know, man. You only have 45 minutes left to live. You'd go buck wild. Some people would anyways.
But here's the thing that I think is sort of interesting. Again, it's contextual, right? Because it's like the one thing that I think drove my coworkers to have this sort of rational thought is they had kids with them, right? So it's like they automatically went into this well, I wouldn't know about automatically because again, like it is pretty superhuman to be able to think that through, but. They had to be calm because they didn't want to scare the kid. And they also had to provide. So I think that's sort of like another wrinkle. It's like if the only thing you're concerned about almost in a morality way, and again, this is almost like this can be sort of macro or micro. It's like, is yourself, then you are only beholden to yourself and you can go take a dump on your boss's, you know, desk. And that, you know, and it's like that is one thing, but it's like I think if you are trying to be responsible for more, for whatever it is, which is sort of the morality, you know, the greater good, be it for, you know, your own offspring or for humanity kind of idea, you know, for people, then you are going to react sort of in a way that is going to try and to manage to the situation in some ways, is my guess. I don't know. I never want to go through it. And I'll tell you what, like, I have some serious doubts about, like, what the hell happened with that whole thing, man. Don't even get me conspiracy'd up, because how the fuck can you just, like, seriously, it's a drop-down menu, and one of them is, like, fucking, you know, grab your ass and play? Well, that doesn't make any sense.
Did you see the picture
it's not true.
They took of the guy that, like, supposedly, like, at the center where they supposedly did the screw-up? His password was on a sticky note on his computer that was shown in the photo.
Yeah.
What's going on?
See, dear listeners, I'm just going to throw this out there for our more conspiratorial minded. There's a whole something else that happened that we have no idea about that could be being sort of swept under the rug on this entire thing. Because I just, like, why wouldn't have that happened before? Why does it happen now? Is it the perfect, quote unquote, the perfect storm of coincidence that brought this out and all of a sudden they had this scare? Or how could that have not happened prior? How could that have not, if it's human nature, then humans fuck up more times than not?
Well, it also seems like already. The kind of thing that should require, like, multiple checks, right? Like, if I, like, yeah. like I was, we were yes. on, we were on you the, are, or yeah. I was on with Rob Christofferson from Our Strange Skies. Yeah. We were on the What If podcast radio show here in Minnesota, and they actually, Minnesota. Which is awesome, and they actually asked, yes. they had the same point, which was like, if I want to delete a file from my desktop, it asks me if I'm sure. Right?
A few
like,
times. Yeah.
Like, are you sure you really want to get rid of that stuff? Like,
yes. If you want to alarm an entire population of nuclear catastrophe, it probably should
have
some safe
checks. But then the point was brought up that, you know, well, actually, like, for a lot of very specific, for very specific or very high end, like, niche computer programs, or like even like whatever engineering programs, whatever, there's no double check. They just assume you know what you're doing. Cause like, think about it. Like, they probably developed the system for, like, they thought, you know, I mean, okay, like, maybe 1,000 people over the lifetime of this program will, like, use this thing, but pretty much
maybe, and it's got to be analog.
Yeah, but
it can't be
exactly,
hacked,
but like, but pretty much it's going to be for, like, a specialty group of users. They're not running, like, QA QC checks, right? Like, they're not doing quality assurance checks to be like, how is the end user, like, will the end user make a mistake? You know what I mean?
No, but. But then that even strengthens the argument that it should have happened multiple times. It should have happened before this. Then, if it's so easy to do,
I don't
then
know.
Why
it's super interesting.
Now?
I find it fascinating. I mean, it's kind of fun. Yeah. Kind of fun to think about.
Rabbit hole. It's kind of fun to think about in theory. Nuclear catastrophe is always fun to, you know, surmise upon from a motherfucking distance. If I got that, oh God, got that text. Holy smokes. Not enough vodka in this here house, my friend. I'll tell you that right now.
All right, let's close it out then. I think that vodka line is a good way to close this out. That's a great way to do it. All right. All right, dear listeners. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the Mad Scientist Podcast. I am, as always, Chris Cogswell, joined by the wonderful Marie Mayhew.
Oh, dear listeners, thanks again. And if you have a near-nuclear catastrophe or have decided to make up a cute pet name for a group of animals, do
absolutely.
Let us know.
Absolutely. Are you kidding me? And we'll be back in a week with the History of Surgery Part 1. We're thinking that's going to be in, like, a three-part series. We have a pretty interesting... Marie, if you couldn't handle explosions this episode, I don't know what you're going to do with surgery next episode.
The history of surgery. Yeah, that's another
getting
light,
serious
fun topic.
Here.
No, it's going to be very interesting. It's going to
be great.
Very interesting.
Thank you again for listening to the podcast. You can get our merchandise at all kinds of cool places.
Buy
Redbubble.com,
our website,
Threadless.com. Mm-hmm. You can support all the artists that do stuff for us. You can check out Not Bad Luck for the pins. You can check out Carrie Shaheen for our logos and all kinds of other cool logos and stuff that she does. She does a lot of amazing things. You can check out Desdemona on Redbubble. And she does some amazing stuff, and she's a huge part of the podcast here. And of course, you can always find all that stuff on our website. And yeah, it's going to be great.
But you can also tweet at us. Tweet at us, my people. At hashtag Team Giant Squid for myself. It's my new hash.
That is Marie's new hash. New whole
Team
thing.
Team Giant Squid.
And you can find us, of course, at Mad Scientist Pod. Thanks again so much for listening, and we will be back in 1 week.
Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X Grown-Up.
Every week, the Gen X Grown-Up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, genxgrownup.com. Life sucks as a grown-up. All right, I think that was good enough.
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right. I've never done it.
No. Right.